Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guests Richard Estep and Cami Anderson, who are the authors of The Haunting of Asylum 49. Richard is also the author of The World's Most Haunted Hospitals and has spent 20 years investigating claims of paranormal phenomena. And Cami Anderson is the owner of the Old Tool Valley Hospital, Asylum 49, along with her husband, Kem. And basically, this is a really interesting story, well-documented paranormal activity at a hospital, at a previous hospital. And it gives us some sort of insight into multidimensional realities that I think it's quite important that we understand exist. Welcome, Richard and Cami. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, it is.
So, where are you all calling in from?
I'm calling in from home in Boulder County, Colorado.
Okay.
And I am calling in from home as well in Tooele, Utah.
Great. Well, Cami, give us a little bit of history about the hospital that is now known as Asylum 49.
Well, it was a community hospital, started construction in 1949 and opened in 1953. The hospital shut down as the community hospital about 13 years ago and was opened up partially as a nursing home. And about 11 years ago, we opened up as a haunted house on the remainder of the hospital. And so here we are today. And recently, we purchased the whole hospital, and the nursing home has a brand new facility, and we are taking possession as of 2 days ago of the whole hospital.
Great. So, Richard, would you like to tell the audience a little bit about your background and some of the methods used in paranormal investigation?
Absolutely. Well, I've been a paranormal investigator for the past 21 years on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm not from around these here parts, as you can probably tell. I come from a city called Leicester in England, famous, I think, for winning the Football Premier League and for burying King Richard under the car park. I came to the U.S. in 1999, and I've been investigating the paranormal or claims of it since 1995. So I make my living as a paramedic, and I was writing a book about haunted hospitals and doing some research on some of the world's most haunted hospitals when I came across the story of Asylum 49 and contacted the owners, Kim and Cami and Dusty, and they invited me to go in and investigate for myself to make up my own mind. So I ended up moving in there for a week over a busy Halloween period, and I took in a team of not only paranormal investigators but also nurses and paramedics so that we could approach it from the medical aspect, you know, so that we could approach it with some sympathy towards the individuals that had lived and died and worked their lives between the walls of the old Tooele Hospital.
It may be that you have a perfect combination here. You have a hospital where, you know, many people died. You know, you talk about the labor and delivery area where, you know, babies sometimes die and sometimes mothers and babies die. And you probably also have within the on the property a portal of sorts that is probably a multidimensional window. And with those two there, it can be very interesting that you have so much activity.
Well, if memory serves, and Cami is the expert because she basically lives there, but it's been said by more than one visiting sensitive that the asylum has multiple portals. Isn't that right, Cami?
It is. They've notified us that there's multiple locations where there's portals, and it ironically, it's down each individual hallway.
Really? That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very fascinating for us and to see how people interact and try to deal with portals has been something that we've watched over the years.
So I was asked at one point, I work with a group here that clears areas, and we were asked at one point to go to Grady Hospital and clear out the ER, because you can imagine how many people die in Grady ER here in Atlanta.
Right.
But essentially, people who are sensitive, whenever they go to anywhere where there are a lot of earthbound spirits, it's really obvious that you know that there are earthbound spirits around. And one of the fascinating things in your book is trying to determine exactly why someone remains earthbound, and if you have an idea that maybe only a portion of that person is earthbound and the rest of them actually went into the light, which I think is a fascinating concept.
Well, I think we tend to make the assumption that when we say a place is haunted, we assume that the entities there are, as we would understand it, always in residence. So sometimes for decades, if not years, or hundreds of years, you know, looking at some of the haunted locations I've done in Great Britain, we have hauntings going back centuries.
Right.
Now, it would drive one quite literally insane to just wander around being unable to interact for centuries. So there is the theory that spirits do not sense time or are not affected by time in the way that the living are. But I think it's also entirely possible when you have these locations that they're able to drop in and out, that sometimes they're elsewhere, that they're not there 24/7, 365.
Right, right. Well, tell us about some of the spirits that you interacted with and how you interacted with them in the asylum.
Well, I think I'll defer to Cammie to give you the rundown of the cast of spirits.
The cast of characters.
Most, yeah, there really is a cast of characters, and I say that with the greatest of respect to them.
Right.
Absolutely. They are definitely very highly regarded at Asylum. We love them. We interact with them quite often. And there is a huge cast, and they are very unique and in their characteristics and behaviors just as much as people are. I guess we'll start down labor and delivery hallway, the maternity hallway. And we'll start with some of my most favorite, most vocals is the children. And they are in the nursery. They go by the names of Sarah and Tabitha. Very, very sweet young girls. Sarah has been known to act in the haunted house and surprise us as well as our visitors. And she's very, just so sweet and cute until she gets scary. And she looks very much like a young girl who's in a nightgown, very, very girly girl, frilly frills, lace, white, all the way down to the floor, clear up to her neck, all the way down her hands. And Tabitha, she's a little bit more sassy. We went years and years not knowing about her until she piped up during one of the investigations where somebody thought they were talking to Sarah. And you hear on the EVP someone say, "I'm not Sarah, I'm Tabitha." And yeah. So she made her first appearance. That was really cute and quite a surprise to us.
Probably back up a little bit and tell people about your recording method, because they may not know what that is.
Right.
How these voices come through.
Yeah. So an EVP is an electronic voice phenomena, and that's when you have a recording device and you ask questions, and on reviewing them later, you'll hear a response that wasn't heard at the time of the recording.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the very, very typical kinds of activity and evidence that we get at Asylum. You're very likely to get one, and you're probably at a 95 to 99% rate of getting those. Our spirits definitely like to talk. They like to converse and communicate and show that they're there.
You also have ways of communicating with them through flashlights. You want to describe that one?
Right. So that is basically, we just call it a flashlight technique. You know, you set a flashlight down and you ask them to respond through the flashlight by turning the flashlight on or off for yes or no. You establish that prior to. A lot of them turn it on for yes. That's how kind of where we go with it. But we've also taken it to different levels and have had two or three flashlights for the different answers. So one to turn on for yes, one to turn on for no, one to turn on for maybe or I don't know. And they've gotten quite good at that as well.
So what are the ways in which you interact with them in terms of, I guess, in the role of the haunted house that you run there? What are some of the things that have come out with that, with that venue?
A lot of the spirits, you never know. There's some that really like the haunted house. There's some mm-hmm. that don't like it as much, and you don't see them during the haunted house. But mm-hmm. individuals such as Sarah, she'll come out during the haunted house, and she will interact with our customers and sometimes with us as well. And one of the times that I personally had was when we had the hallway had beds staggered, and every other one had a pretend body in it, I guess, and it was covered by sheets. And this mm-hmm. particular scene was from the movie Possession. And anybody that has not seen that, it was based on a demon, the Dybbuk. And there was a father and a daughter who were the stars of it. And the daughter got possessed by the Dybbuk. And during that show, there was one scene where she was in a morgue and she was underneath the exit sign. And she would say, "Daddy, you scared me," as he approached.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah came up behind us. I saw a light behind us. And I mm-hmm. turned around and I saw Sarah walking towards us saying, "Daddy, you scared me." And she was there. It was crazy.
That was crazy. Yeah. So some of the other, let's talk about some of the other spirits that have interacted with you that may not be as friendly as Sarah. And is it Tabitha? I'm sorry, I forgot it. Tabitha, yeah.
Right.
They're pretty benign, although they can scare you if they grab your leg. You know, that's what
right.
Sarah was doing, yeah.
Right. It's all in good fun for them. They enjoy that. I think it helps pass the time and keeps them interacting. But we do have some spirits that don't always have the best intentions towards mm-hmm. everybody. And I wouldn't call them negative. A lot of people will misconstrue behaviors of entities acting aggressively mm-hmm. as demonic or some kind of negative entity. But one of the things that we've noticed over the years is that they're very much like the living, where if you are angry in life and mean mm-hmm. in life, you'll probably also be like that in death. Mm-hmm. So we do have some of those, and it's not always just their characteristics. For example, we have one of the spirits that we have down that same hall that Sarah and Tabitha reside is named Wesley.
Mm-hmm.
And we found him in history. We've been able to track him, talk with family members, and found out that he did, in fact, pass from complications with Alzheimer's. And for mm-hmm. whatever reason, it appears that he has taken that into death, or, as you spoke earlier, left that portion behind.
Mm-hmm.
And at times, he can be pretty aggressive if he's had a bad day.
Right. As Alzheimer's patients will do. They have a Jekyll Hyde
right.
personality sometimes near the end, yeah.
Right.
And there was
that's just one of them.
I'm sorry?
I was going to say, that's just one of them. We have a few more of those. One in
okay.
which
well,
Richard
go ahead.
Actually
go
came
ahead.
Into contact
yeah.
with when he came and visited.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard, do you want to tell him about that?
About room 666, you mean? Or
about
the Guardian. The
Guardian.
So
yes.
he was an interesting character, and from what I'd been told, he's an aggressive kind of bullying personality. He sticks very much to the old wing of the hospital, which is all out on one side, so it's the older part, and that tends to be a place where staff that volunteer or work there don't like to go alone or at all. And that goes mm-hmm. double for the female staff, because they've been pushed, in some cases, pinched, slapped, poked, bitten, you name it, by this particular entity, which seems to enjoy trying to intimidate people that are in his area. So when I heard this, I don't like bullies. I never have. It comes from having been a bullied child myself. So I thought a great thing to do would be to go onto his turf and try and face him down.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with one of my fellow investigators, and we took a visitor that was also a sensitive along with us, and went into the Guardian's area. And I was fully expecting nothing to happen. And I was being told by the sensitive that he'd taken a strong dislike to me personally.
yeah.
Perhaps because as head of the team, I was an authority figure, and I was most definitely not intimidated. So I began to bait him a little bit. And I'm not someone that advocates provocation during research, except under very rare circumstances. I believe you should generally be respectful, mm-hmm. as you would be with any stranger that you meet. But I think that you can kind of put that on hold when you're dealing with someone who's been so physically abusive to so many people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was being very challenging to him, is how I would put it. And she told me that he was getting right in my face, although I couldn't see him, and that he was screaming profanities and obscenities at me. And I began to laugh at him, and I had a few choice words myself. And it felt very surreal, because if you've never had a blazing argument with thin air, it feels a little bit foolish.
yeah.
And she said, you know, he's leaving. He's slinking away with his tail between his legs. Metaphorically mm-hmm. speaking. And I took that with a grain of salt. And then just then, we have this on our voice recorders also, we heard the sound of heavy footsteps disappearing away from the room into the maze outside.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And I gather that the Guardian is still around. The research that the resident the staff at the asylum have done on him seems to imply that during his lifetime, he was an employee at the hospital. Not a particularly high-ranking one in the organizational structure, but one who liked to be in everybody's business. He liked to mm-hmm. have something on you. He liked to pry. Is that not so, Kemi?
Right. Correct.
I had an interesting experience here. We have a 10,000-square-foot surgery center, medical facility, obviously, and four operating rooms. And it was an insurance building before we renovated it. And there was a person who died of a heart attack. And I think when we moved in, there was at least 30 or 40 people that actually saw this person at different times, usually early in the morning. He wouldn't try to scare you. He would just interact with the ones he knew that weren't real frightened of him. And the only ones he would really try to scare were people that intended to steal or harm me. For some reason, he became very, very protective of me. And he even went home with me sometimes. And his name was Ken. And he would write on the walls warnings if I needed to know something. And he would, like the motion detectors would go off for no reason, and the alarms would go off. And I think that was if somebody was even approaching the building to do anything. We never got robbed. Everything was, you know, the security was really, really good when Ken was here. And basically, I only saw him once. I was in broad daylight. I was the only person in the building. He walked down the hall and then walked through a wall. But he was very, very solid. He was wearing a plaid shirt. And I wouldn't have known he was a spirit except he walked through the wall. I went to either side of the building to see that there were no cars, so I knew it had to be him because nobody else was in the building, and he walked through the wall. But I would communicate with him all the time because I have spiritual hearing, and he would tell me all sorts of stuff that he did for me. It was amazing to have a spirit that was so protective here. And now we have a bunch of spirits here that are protective. I mean, things fly off the wall if they want to get my attention. We've had pictures fly off the wall. We've had all sorts of stuff. And all it is to get my attention. So I will communicate with them. The fire alarm went off 3 times without the fire, no fire being here. Just the fire alarm went off. And then twice now, the TV volume has gone way up. And the only way you can get it back down is to unplug it. I mean, you can't turn the volume back down. So we have all sorts of phenomena here, but it's all very, very protective. I have super protection here.
Well, I think that I've seen it go both ways, and I know that Cammie's husband, Kim, certainly has had experiences where the children from Asylum 49 have followed him home, and also something that was entirely more, I would say, malicious, right, Cammie? He was attacked, as I recall.
Right.
At one point also.
That's right. He was, I think that's something that just happens when you are in the business of paranormal investigating, and especially when you have a location that you're at frequently, just like your office that you spoke about having someone follow you home. And they're not always nice. I think that we have quite a, like we said, a pretty big cast of spirits. And, Kim had one follow him home that was very menacing and frightening. It held him down in bed one night and had this putrid smell, and he didn't know if he was going to make it. It was towards the beginning of our experiences at the hospital, and he came in as a complete skeptic, where he didn't even believe in it. In fact, he would tell you were crazy if you told him about ghosts and that there was such thing. So to him, it was definitely a terrifying incident.
But have you seen that entity ever again? Or do you think yes. It just came in that, have you?
Yes, we have actually. And he seems to be fairly grumpy, and not just in general. He doesn't like the ghost hunting. We've caught EVPs and voices through the voice boxes and spirit boxes that he's told us he's not a performing circus monkey. And so we definitely leave him alone. We don't try to interrogate him. And I make sure that people know when they do come to the location that in that area there's a gentleman that really doesn't like to be communicated with. And so talk to him at your own risk. But I wouldn't recommend it.
Right. So there's a fascinating story in the book about a boy that died of an accident. You want to tell that? That was fascinating.
Right. So there's a lot of spirits at the haunted house at Asylum 49. And very often we come across some that just kind of spill their guts and tell us everything about them. They'll tell us their names and the incidents that brought them to their death. And one such incident was in room 20, where there was a little boy who was in there, and he was telling us about how he had passed and that was in an accident and that it was a family member that had caused the accident. And we thought, wow, this is really neat. Again, this was towards the beginning of the adventures in ghost hunting. And we thought it was really cool. So we decided to relay the stories. Of course, when we're doing tours, like we do, we want to have those stories and tell people about what we found. And we were telling a group during one of these tours about the little boy and what he had said. And we noticed there was a woman who was crying during the tour. And so we kind of took note of that and moved on throughout the tour. And after the tour, we asked her if she was okay and what had happened. And she told us, and she's very angry, she told us that the person we were talking about was her nephew. And she was extremely mad because this was kind of a family secret. She didn't understand how we knew it. She wanted to know who told us. Because there was, again, very few people who really knew the details that we had. And we told her that he told us. There was the little boy told us. And we played the EVPs for her. And she was just completely shocked and had to go in the room and talk to him as well. And after that incident occurred, we were just, oh my gosh, during that, later that night, very relieved that it had gone off and it didn't turn into a terrible incident. Went home very relieved, and until the next morning when we woke up and looked at the email and discovered that his mom wanted to meet with us.
Right.
And so we ended up meeting with her, and she wanted to, she listened to the EVPs that we got and said it sounded a lot like her son. But of course, she was very skeptical and very, you know, kind of on her guard as well, because that's, it's just very odd to have something like that happen for anybody. And so she wanted to go into the room and talk to him, and we took her in there, and we had a flashlight session with the little boy. The mother asked certain questions that only he would know, and she got the answers that she wanted and she knew were correct. And she left feeling a lot better, I hope. At the time, we were like, oh, I hope she feels a lot better. But later on, you know, time went on, a few months later, and we did get an email from her saying that she was really grateful for the opportunity to talk to him one last time, and that there was a lot of things that were cleared up for her, and she was glad to know that he was okay, because that was some of the messages that he relayed to her, was that he was okay, he's not in pain, he's happy, and wanted her to be happy also. And that made us feel really good, and we haven't heard from him since.
And I think it's really important, one other piece of information he gave you was that it was his time to go. In other words, it was his death date. And that,
right.
So the person, the family member that shot him accidentally, could then kind of rest assured that everything was really in divine order and that he hadn't cut this life short.
Right.
And that's usually the case, by the way. That really is usually the case. There aren't that many people that die before their death date. There's a few that hang on for a couple of weeks after their death date, but most people die on their death date. And we have multiple potential death dates. But, you know, they're usually one that is prearranged. And the way the little boy went out then gives a lot of opportunity for learning forgiveness in the family left behind.
Right, it definitely did. And the family member who did shoot him struggled for quite some time about it. And it seemed to have helped him to know that he didn't blame him for it, that it was supposed
right.
to happen, like you said. And like I said, I haven't heard from this family after we got that last email saying that they
yeah.
have some closure. But I do hope that they all move forward with a lot less trouble and guilt and things like that.
But, you know, it really is possible using these methods to get a bunch of information about people who are murdered, you know, people who are, you know, have died deaths that have mystery surrounding them. You know, I'm hoping we're going to be moving into an area where these methods are much more likely to be used. I know
right.
that a number of, we know the military does remote viewing all the time, and the
mm-hmm.
you know, the CIA and the FBI use remote viewing, and a lot of police forces are open to, you know, known psychic and medium information
right.
coming in. But these are
right.
these are great tools where you can perhaps get information directly from the person who's deceased, who has, you know, information that's quite, you know, may be quite relevant to the case.
Right. And a lot of times because we've gotten a few things like that before and have been able to talk with some of the families, but it doesn't mean that they give you all the information. A lot of times we have to do our own research as well and try
mm-hmm.
to piece it together the best that we can.
Right. Yeah. So do you think that most people that died at the hospital moved on? I mean, I guess you don't really know how many people died at the hospital, but if the hospital was there that long, you can imagine that many people died at the hospital, because especially before hospice, almost everybody that died in the hospital. You know, it's
right.
unusual. I don't know when hospice came into being, but it was probably in the 70s, I think. Do you know, Richard, being in the medical field, when hospice became more prominent?
You're asking about the number of patients that died in the hospital?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, what percentage stay earthbound, and, like, why do you think they stay earthbound?
Well, I'm not, personally at least, this is just my viewpoint, I'm not willing to attribute all of the activity that goes to earthbound entities at all. Pardon me for one moment, I apologize. I think that a fair number of drop-ins, and one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is the location of the hospital. It's next mm-hmm. to the town cemetery, and until last week, it was directly adjacent to a nursing home, a retirement facility that adjoins it. So there's this interesting triad of energy going on in that location.
So do you know, in your communications with the spirits, have most of them identified that they died in the hospital, or are there some that just don't identify anything?
You know, some worked there and didn't.
Some do what now?
Oh, boy. I wonder if we lost him.
We may have. We can try to get him back.
Like he was saying, yeah, some of them actually have worked there. There have been some that have communicated that they passed there. We also have some that are just passersby. We don't mm-hmm. know always where they come from. We theorize that they may come from the cemetery and have known mm-hmm. that, you know, maybe felt some energy coming from there.
Right.
Or perhaps were just passing through because it was mm-hmm. a familiar location, and then there was somebody communicating, and they thought, oh, great, there's somebody here to talk to, and so they stuck around. Mm-hmm. We also wonder if people have brought spirits with them and just kind of dropped them off there.
Sure.
Again, because they can, that's a location where people talk to them quite frequently, and they can
right.
be heard. So there's quite a gambit of just a huge, diverse group of spirits there, and we don't always know who they are when we're talking to them. We have familiar spirits, and if we hear them, we know who they are. We know, like I said, their mannerisms, mm-hmm. Their characteristics, the locations that they're normally in. We're mm-hmm. well aware of that. And so sometimes we do get those spirits that we don't really know too much about.
And I'm back. I apologize for being
wrong
there.
Good.
I finished that for you, Richard.
Thank you so much.
I want to tell a short story about something very strange that happened here in Atlanta.
Sure.
I live about 4 miles from my office, and a shortcut there is called Happy Hollow. And every time I was driving down that road, I could feel spirits come into the van, and, you know, the kind of cold and chills and the creepy feelings and everything. And it was just in Happy Hollow when I was on that road. So I was asking, we had a meditation group that meets and does soul releasement as part of what we do. And so I asked, why are you guys here? What do you want? And the answer was they wanted to go into the light. They wanted to for us to release them. And so we did that. I guess I brought them back with me one night. We have meditation on Sunday. And I work with a shaman that is very good at opening portals and getting people out. But it turned out that about 1,000 souls passed that night. But this whole area was never developed. It was like, you know, there's like abandoned stuff on it and half-built houses. And, you know, nothing was ever, you couldn't really build and do things like you would think you would be able to. And then once those spirits passed, the whole area built up with no trouble. You know, construction was fine, and nobody had creepy feelings anymore. One of my doctors lived near there. And I said, did you ever have, like, real creepy feelings driving down that road? He said, yeah. You know, before you released all of them, I had the feelings a lot. They even named the road Happy Hollow. So they must have been there a while.
Mm.
Wow.
But they were
wow.
ready to go, and they followed me back to the center. And you know, the simple thing of opening the portal and letting them go. And I've never felt a creepy feeling since then driving down that road. So
yeah,
it's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I always get asked the question about whether we cross our spirits over or not, whether we're trying to keep them there for, you know, to show hauntings and have tours and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we found out, because we do go and cross them over if we can, and we do cleanse the area and things like that. But one thing that we did find is that they don't go if they're not ready. You can't force them to leave.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because that's quite a large amount of people to go at one time.
It really was. But it was a whole area. I mean, it was a pretty big area. I went on a ghost tour in Savannah. You probably, if you haven't been to Savannah, it is really a town for ghost tours. And at the beginning of the tour, we were in a trolley, or, you know, a thing that has a bunch of people that rolls around the city. I guess you call it a trolley. It was a motor vehicle. And I was just sitting there, and I asked the question if anybody in spirit wanted to come back with me, you know, we could do a releasing if they wanted, you know, just if they wanted. And so the most weird thing happened to me. A spirit jumped into my body. I don't know if you've ever had that happen, but a spirit jumped into my body and started talking to me. But he really was jumping. I mean, he really jumped in. He was friendly. But he said, are you serious? Do you really mean you can do this? I said, yeah, we've done it a lot. He said, I'm going to go out and see if anybody wants to. And so I told him I was going to be driving back to Atlanta on Sunday, and then Sunday night we would have the meeting. And it turned out that 68 spirits from Savannah were released in Atlanta. So, but there was probably a lot more spirits than that in Savannah. I'm sure there's, I mean, tens of thousands of them, considering all the ghost tours there. I mean, it's just incredible the number of, the history of Savannah is really amazing. So only 68 wanted to go, at least, you know, from what he was saying. But I just thought that was interesting, too. But it was so interesting that on the ghost tour, I didn't see anything other than, you know, those infrared lights where the balls go all over the room and you can see that there's a huge number of spirits in the room. I mean, that was interesting. But I didn't have any other interactions with any spirits on the ghost tour. But right when we were starting, that spirit jumped in and asked me if I was serious about this releasement thing.
So, wow. Yeah, I've never
so
had
it. So if you want to release them, you can. I mean, some will take you up on it, and they'll even make the trip back to Atlanta with you.
Yeah, we do try to cross them over periodically. I definitely, like I said, never had anybody jump into me or anything like that. I'm not psychic. I do know how to tell different energies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that we have found, like I said, is that they don't go unless they're ready. And so
That's very true.
we don't do it and definitely don't allow others to do it because especially in the case of Wesley, the Alzheimer's patient, we've tried to cross him over so many times because, I mean, he's very lost, very, very lost.
Yeah.
And he's definitely one that we know is stuck. A lot of them aren't, but he is. And we just got so tired and just started feeling very bad about kicking him out of his home, what he perceives as his home, and thought,
right.
You know, as far as he's concerned, we'll just leave that to the other side or look for signs to see if he's ready, and then we'll do what we can to help him. But, yeah, I'm sure there's so many that are out there that really do want to cross over and don't know how.
Yeah, the people that don't want to cross over primarily are frightened. Like we had this long discussion with one that was actually haunting a house, and the owners asked us to intervene. And when we were speaking with him, he said that he had killed so many people in, I think it was World War II, and that he was afraid to cross over.
Right.
It was almost like he thought he was going to go to hell. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times you can talk to you can answer their questions and alleviate their fears. And especially if they're fairly intelligent, they will go ahead and cross over. But I think the Alzheimer's present a particularly bad problem in that their mental functioning is not really there. I think that is the problem. You can't reason with them.
Right, and that's a lot of why you focus on him.
One of the fascinating aspects of that, as far as I'm concerned, is that Alzheimer's is we're talking about an organic brain disease.
Right.
By all rights, by all commonly accepted definitions, it should not follow you into mm-hmm. any kind of energy state. It should not stay with you when you pass over. And yet, in some cases, that does seem to be the case. I've talked to a number of palliative care nurses and physicians when I was writing The World's Most Haunted Hospitals, and there's a phenomenon where many patients who do have this deep confusion that comes along with dementia, as they're about to die, they have a very lucid period. It's usually short, but it's a very lucid moment. It's as though the veil or whatever it is kind of lifted for a moment for them before they cross. So it fascinates me that we have some cases on record, and Wesley's the one I'm most familiar with, in which it seems to work in the opposite way, that they retain some kind of confusion after transitioning.
Well, I think I can answer that a little bit. As a plastic surgeon, I would get called to nursing homes and hospitals where Alzheimer's patients would have really bad pressure sores, and I know you've seen these because they tend to be very bad wounds that often get down in the bone. And, of course, we really don't want to operate on them because a lot of times many operations are needed. It's very expensive. And so I would go to the hospital, and I'd have to do my paperwork. But I would always communicate, like telepathically with the patient. And I would explain to them, I would ask them why they don't want to die. And they would tell me. They would tell me why they were afraid to die. And I would explain to them what their thought processes weren't thinking properly. And then we'd have this telepathic communication. It would last probably usually about 20 minutes. And then I'd leave, and then I would be told the next morning they were dead. So it may be that some Alzheimer's patients are supposed to go, but because of a deep-seated fear of death, hold on. So that's
maybe.
Yeah, then Wesley, still has that deep-seated fear of death, so he's not gonna want to cross over because he still has the misconceptions, the fire and brimstone stuff and the Southern Baptist stuff that's taught that really, if you believe it, you might be very frightened to die.
Yeah,
if you die, then to cross over,
The literature is very clear on the fact that one's experience at the moment of crossing over seems to correlate with their deeply held beliefs, which is why those that do believe that they're going, somewhere fire and brimstone for all eternity, are indeed very anxious. Those that are a little bit more au fait with the spirit world and with the concept of an afterlife where they're not going to necessarily suffer or be judged or anything like that, seem to have a smoother and easier transition.
Right, that's true. But a lot of times, I think that you just have to explain things to people. They have misconceptions. And, the better thing is for people to cross over if they can. I've dealt with a lot of spirits that were murdered, and they want to stay here because they want their murder solved. And so, I'll be in the middle of surgery sometime, and somebody who's been murdered will come to me and start talking to me in the middle of surgery about evidence that they want me to look into. And it's really pretty interesting. And certainly, people who are murdered often stay around until the crime is solved.
Well, we have this age-old, going back to the first ghost stories that the Romans gave us, this age-old belief that one of the reasons for spirits to remain earthbound or to return is to see a wrong righted or unfinished business, you know?
Right. It's really true.
I mean, that's it's very well documented, isn't it, going back thousands of years?
Yeah. So I'm hoping that some of this technology that you're using can be used to help these spirits right some of these wrongs. I think it would be wonderful to work with law enforcement and to have the information that the deceased have available.
Well, I think
to law enforcement.
The case that you spoke about, that Cammy alluded to, in which you had an accidental death. It seems that interaction gave the family some degree of closure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which is immensely valuable.
Too.
Yeah. Hmm. So what are the plans in the future for Asylum 49? What are you doing now?
Oh, I'm never going back near that place again.
Too frightening.
No, I'm kidding. In fact, I fly out. I go back there next week, a week from yesterday, because... there has been an area that's always been off limits. The retirement home, the skilled nursing facility, has always been off limits because it has residents. They've now moved out to a newer facility. So just last night, I believe it was, or the night before, I think Cammy and Tim took ownership of that section of the building.
Right.
It's already very paranormally active. So I'm going back to visit my Asylum 49 family and investigate this new section of the building. It's like unwrapping a big... paranormal Christmas gift.
Great. Well, and for our listeners, this facility is outside Salt Lake City. So, Cammy, you want to tell the listeners a little bit about it if they want to come visit?
Yes. It's about 50 miles west of Salt Lake City in a little town of Tooele. And you would just follow the signs, I guess, to get there. Also, if you are interested in visiting, you can go to our website at www.asylum49.com, or you can email at ghosthunt@asylum49.com.
Great. And do you have tours all throughout the year?
We start about January, and then stop during August in the haunted house season. And then every once in a while we have some investigations during the Halloween season, but it's very, very rare because we are open late and we're all tired. And it would be very late that the investigations would take place.
And usually we're living there.
And usually, right, Richard and the gang are there.
So you hire people to do the haunted house then? Is that correct? How many people do you usually hire?
We actually have volunteers. The haunted house was started by Kim. It's kind of his baby, his little dream child here. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is, as a young kid, Kim was kind of an at-risk teenager. Mm-hmm. And one day he just wandered into a haunted house, and he started acting there. And that kind of saved him from going down the wrong path. And he always vowed that if he was ever able to do it, he would open up a haunted house and try to return that favor and help out and mentor kids just like he was. And that's kind of how things started here. And that's where it is also continuing to go. But we do help and mentor have about 150 people volunteer every year.
Wow, that's quite a number.
It is. We're a very small town, and a lot of the teenagers don't have too many places to go. So we kind of give them a place to go that's a safe environment, with people who are upstanding members of the community as adults, and kind of give them a little bit of direction outside of their parental structure.
Right. Well, in your book, you talk a lot about the different manifestations that you've seen, and that one of the things I appreciated was that you talk about some of the manifestations. You really can't tell them from normal people, except that you know that they're your spirits that you know very well. They manifest so much in the physical that you would swear that they're just a person standing across the room. You want to tell a story about that? Because you've got a couple of good ones in the book.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's the one about Sarah that I spoke about earlier, and she was very, very solid, with the exception of just the light coming from her. That was extremely odd. But for me, one of the first apparition I saw was that of a nurse, and it was during the haunted house season. I don't know how ever, you know, how many people watch horror movies, but we had one of the rooms based on the movie Silent Hill, and there was a bunch of the nurses. If anybody remembers the nurses that were there, they would be very still until they noticed somebody was in the area. Then they'd get very homicidal. But we had a room like that, and there were some static nurses and some living people in costumes. Uh-huh. And when people would walk through, you'd be able to scare them in that way. Right. One of the things that was unique about the room was that it had strobe lights as the effect. So when you hit the fake nurses, they kind of moved, they bopped around and looked very, kind of really jerky in the strobe lights.
Right.
But one thing about strobe lights is that if you're in them too long, they give you headaches, they can make you dizzy, and make you not feel very good. So the cast would leave the room when the group had passed and then come back in when another group was coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these nights, we were very short on cast, and I went in there as one of the nurses and acted myself. And as we were leaving the room to go sit out in the hallway after a group had passed through, one of the girls in front of me was walking very slowly and kind of very shaky and jerky, and her head was cocked very far to the side. And I was concerned. I was thinking, oh, no, we're going to lose another actor. She's not feeling very good. So I just kind of walked and was trying to follow her through to the other side. And I reached my hand up and moved the plastic separating the rooms aside. And it was at that moment that it occurred to me that the nurse in front of me had disappeared.
Right.
And the other girls were outside sitting on the ground.
Right.
And at the time, I didn't even really think about it. Like I said, I didn't know that it was anything other than the girl in front of me, but it was, in fact, a spirit.
Yeah. Well, that was like the guy I saw, Ken. I saw him one time, and Ken said to me, "We cannot control who sees us and doesn't see us." Isn't that interesting?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. He didn't realize that I had seen
could.
Him. He was just walking around the center. And so evidently sometimes they're real material, and then other times they're more like shadows. You know, it just depends on, I guess, how much energy they have manifesting right then. So there's a lot we have to learn about this, and it's just really fascinating stuff. Thank you both for writing the book. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Thank you for reading it and having us as your guests. We appreciate
that. Well, would you like to give your contact information one more time before we go?
Certainly. Come and visit me online at www.richardestep.net. That's Richard, ESTEP.net.
Great. And Cammie?
And you can find us at www.asylum49.com, or you can email at ghosthunt@asylum49.com, and as always, Facebook.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been interviewing Richard Estep and Cammie Anderson, their book, The Haunting of Asylum 49. If either of you have any other books that you'd like to interview on, please give us a ring or an email. We'd love to have you back on. Next week, we have Kate Montana, The E-Word, Ego, Enlightenment, and Other Essentials. This is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.